We did. So we're going to talk about civil legal aid in Minnesota. We're going to provide an overview of Minnesota's statewide civil legal services network. We're going to talk about the need for civil legal aid in Minnesota. We're going to talk about funding for civil legal aid in Minnesota. We're going to talk about some of the outcomes we achieve, and we're going to talk about equal access to justice and leveling the playing field for Minnesotans all over the state. So on, I'm just trying to see if we're going to get synced up here.
Ooh, it just flickered on.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Considine.
While they're doing that, should we inquire if there's anybody from Hamlin Law School from the class?
Point. It would help your cause.
I'm a University of Minnesota Law School graduate.
I'm Mitchell Hamlin.
Ooh, strike two. Actually, they're merged now, right?
So. Yeah. All right, so we have our slideshow up now. So first we're going to start by saying, what is civil legal services? So you see the acronym CLS in the budget line item. That stands for civil legal services. We're commonly called legal aid. Civil legal aid, legal aid. We provide free legal help to people with low incomes, people with disabilities, seniors, vulnerable people in Minnesota who have civil legal problems. So non-criminal, civil legal problems. And legal aid is the popular name. And what we do is we help people access basic necessities, family safety, financial security, health care, housing stability, economic stability, employment, education, and we protect people's civil rights in those areas. We do this free of charge. We are a group of nonprofit law firms, and we work with the private bar and leverage our expertise working with volunteers, including private attorneys, law students, paralegals, and using the best available technologies to punch above our weight, as it were, since we're under-resourced in what we're trying to do. Statewide, we have 260 legal aid attorneys representing people in civil cases in court and in administrative proceedings around the state. And one of the functions, of course, that we do is we also see people before they formally enter those proceedings, and we screen out cases that don't have merit, and we give advice and counsel to folks to make sure that those systems work efficiently and effectively for the people. The types of cases we do, I mentioned basic necessities. So this would include things like preventing illegal evictions to keep a roof over families' heads, making sure seniors have appropriate health insurance and services in nursing homes or assisted living facilities. We are also trying to protect foundational life safety and stability. So this would include protecting survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault or victims of other crimes, keeping children and youth in school, and making sure that people have access to education and nutrition, healthcare, and safety. And you know, we'll go to court and get orders for protection for people and make sure that children and survivors of violence are safe. And then, of course, we also are stabilizing families' financial situations. So we're protecting their economic security, and this could include doing work in taxpayer advocacy, consumer protection, public benefits for temporary support during life crises that arise for people who don't have emergency savings, that type of work, and making sure that people are stabilized and they don't, you know, slide down a slippery slope towards homelessness or unstable and unpleasant outcomes for their families. How do we do this? Well, what we do is a variety of different services. So we will do full representation work, which is we stand by a person throughout a proceeding. We go to court with them. We go to an administrative proceeding with them. And we stand by their side throughout that proceeding. We will also provide advice and limited representation. So we will counsel people about their cases, consult with them, negotiate with adverse parties or government bureaucrats that are they're interacting with, and we will make sure that people get to the right service for their needs. And one of the ways that we do this is we have a number of web-based services and free community education materials. Our website, lawhelpmn.org, which we've been highlighting to those of you with whom we've met to this point, is a statewide service that's provided to people regardless of income. It is basically a free service to the public where they can learn basic information about their civil rights in a number of different areas. And this tool that we have at LawHelp is just remarkable as a resource that is consulted 1,000 times a day by people all over Minnesota. So in 2018, 380,000 people went to lawhelpmn.org to learn about their rights and to get information so that they can self-advocate. And through that website, people can also connect with our legal aid network and can get to one of our offices where they can find an attorney who can help represent them. To give you an example of a couple stories of our work that I think highlight what we do. So we had a case that came up in northeastern Minnesota where a survivor of domestic violence who had post-traumatic stress disorder was facing unhealthy and unsafe living conditions in her home. And when she complained about that, she was given an illegal notice to move from her home. At the same time, the conditions in her home and the lack of access to an attorney led to a situation where she did not have custody of her children at the time this was going on. So we interacted with her and stopped the illegal eviction first. And then we worked with her and were able to make sure that she was able to protect her family, get her kids back into her care, protect them from family violence, and we also were able to make sure that she had access to a housing subsidy that helped her move to a safer living environment for her family. So that's illustrative of when we do cases, they'll sometimes cross multiple practice areas. We may work on a housing piece of a case for somebody, simultaneously have a domestic violence piece of a case for somebody, and maybe interacting with federal and state benefits for the person to make sure that they're...
One moment, Mr. Schaefer. Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Schaefer, thank you. I just had a question. Do you provide any family law services at all or not?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Mr. Schaefer. And Jean Lustein can speak to that.
Yeah, Family law, Representative Mueller, is one of the top two areas that we represent folks in, the other one being housing. We do a lot of family law. It's everything from orders for protection, which sort of are the top tier type of cases that we do, but lots of dissolutions of marriage. We do parenting 10 cases. We do custody cases for unmarried parents. And we do what we call third-party custody cases where, you know, for example, a grandparent might be seeking custody of children because the parents are unable to perform that role at the time. So we do lots of family law cases.
Representative Mueller?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just was wondering that with respect to the domestic violence cases, just because that's an important part for survivors of domestic violence often to have that family law help as well.
Yes.
Ms. Lustein.
Top priority.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Schaefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The second story I'll mention is a case that came out of the Twin Cities area, and this was a case where an elderly woman was living in a nursing home setting and became ill and was out of balance with her medications. She ended up being hospitalized. And after she'd been treated in the hospital and had her health improved to a point where she was ready to return home, she was informed she could not return home. And she hadn't been formally discharged from the place where she had been living, a place she had called home for many years. And she was getting the runaround. She did not have any knowledge about what she could do about this. She reached out to us, and we took on her case, and we started, we brought a legal proceeding, and then we appealed her treatment and being denied access. And once we did that, the people that treated her at the hospital and helped improve her health to the point that she was ready to return home came and testified and stood by her in the proceeding with our attorney, and she was able to get what she deserved, which was the right to return to her home where she is living right now to this day still happily and safely. And, you know, without access to us, and, you know, this is an area, I know that the legislature has been very interested in the issue of the treatment of elder Minnesotans, and, you know, we don't have a lot of attorneys to do that work, but we have a few around the state, and we do that type of work on a day-to-day basis to protect the most vulnerable people who are, you know, oftentimes without recourse, unless they have someone by their side to make sure that they have their rights vindicated.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I'm just wondering, the case that you just described, we have this thing called the Office of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. And I just wonder, and I know they're understaffed and underfunded, and I, you know, I'm sure everybody is, I'm sure you are as well, but is what's the crossover there? I mean, why would she come to you as opposed to going to them? Would they provide similar service?
Mr. Schaefer?
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's a great question. Actually, in that case, the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care contacted us to get involved because that office had been working on the case and was running into roadblocks. You know, and we work really closely with that office. We communicate with them regularly and talk to them about trends that we see in our offices and hear from them about things that they're seeing in the communities around Minnesota so that we can be strategic about, you know, new approaches to representing that population. But it just so happens that in that case, that is exactly what happened. They know how to get in touch with us when they see a case like that where they don't feel what's happening is right, and they've exhausted their ability to advocate for the person in question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that because, you know, I was a little concerned whether there's duplication going on, but that sounds really good because that office, of course, not every case is going to need legal intervention. Oftentimes it's just going to be information or some kind of advocacy that falls short of needing a lawyer. And, of course, having a lawyer is a more limited resource yet. So I'm really glad to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Schaefer,
please proceed. Thanks. So the impact that we have with this work that we do is we promote strong and stable families. We do this by preventing homelessness. We stabilize safe housing. And when I say that, I mean that we make sure that housing is healthy and safe for people because there's a lot of folks that we represent who aren't living in the best places and they have unhealthy and dangerous living conditions. They often have children who are exposed to environmental contaminants and things like that, and we make sure that we address those issues. We reduce domestic violence and protect survivors to make sure that they can live safe lives free from harassment and the risk to their personal safety. We ensure access to health care, which is a big issue, and we help a lot of people who don't know what options they have, make sure that they connect with the right care for their situations. We also help seniors and people with disabilities live independently. I just mentioned the story about the work that we did in that senior law case. And you know, we also serve people with disabilities statewide in making sure that we protect their civil rights and their access to different services and programming to which they're entitled. And, you know, we also are working toward the cause of equal justice for all. We are contributing to the core judicial branch goal and the values that I think that Minnesotans have about making sure that everybody has meaningful access to justice. And we do that with our web-based services and public education materials. We do that by being present in court settings regularly. And we do that by increasing the efficiency and effectiveness of the system as it operates by interacting with people, counseling them about their rights so that they are presenting accurate information and meaningful and relevant information to tribunals and administrative law judges all over the state. And then also, of course, counseling people when they don't have a good case or where judicial or legal intervention isn't the best solution for them in their situation. We also promote innovation, and so then this is one of the things that we're very proud of. So we are a founding partner in 7 domestic violence court partnerships in Minnesota. So we list the counties that we serve. Jean, her program has started one of the more recent one of these domestic violence partnerships in Hennepin County District Court, but we've been present in these other counties for the last several years, and what we're doing is we're working with prosecutors, we're working with victim and survivor advocacy groups, we're working with the court, and we're identifying people and helping them at the location of need for legal interventions, being at court when and where they need us. And similarly, we've also really ramped up in the last several years the creation and establishment and development of medical legal collaborations, or commonly called medical legal partnerships. And what we do in medical legal partnerships is we go to hospitals and community medical clinics and places where people are seeking medical care or health care, and we have attorneys there. And when people identify problems that in their lives that have a medical component and a legal component, we work with them to find the appropriate legal intervention to help them resolve it. So just here's an example. So a family goes to a medical clinic with asthmatic children who are continuing to suffer from symptoms of asthma. And during the course of a medical consultation, it comes out in the discussion with the medical professional who's treating them that they are living in a place where there's mold in the living environment due to recurring water intrusion in the home, for example. So in a case like that, the medical professional we work with to integrate our services would send the case to our attorney, and then we would look at the health and safety of the living environment and use legal representation to fix the mold problem or environmental problem in the home so that the medical treatment can be effective. Because in a case like that, no amount of treatment is going to resolve the medical situation until the underlying environmental situation is resolved. So that's just one example, and there are others I could give as well. But we were doing that increasingly. We have a couple of these partnerships in Minneapolis, a couple in St. Cloud, a couple in St. Paul, and then we have a lot of coverage in different parts of the state in different community clinics and hospital settings. How do we do all this from a structural standpoint? Well, we have six regional programs that cover the broad range of civil legal aid work with attorneys doing the work. We touch every corner of Minnesota, every square inch of Minnesota, all 87 counties and all the tribal lands. There are also, beyond the six regional programs that do the broad array of civil legal aid work, there are smaller offices that provide legal aid to specific populations or specific geographical areas. And overall, there's approximately two dozen civil legal aid providers around Minnesota that work together as a network to provide these services. So the most recent data from that we have available is last year we served over 100,000 Minnesotans in 46,000 cases. To be eligible for our services, the primary income test is at or below 125% of federal poverty guidelines, or functionally at or below 125% of federal poverty guidelines. To give you a picture of what that looks like, for a family of four with the current federal poverty guidelines, that would be an annual income of $32,188. And we've talked a little bit about the types of cases we do. They're civil, and they involve those basic life needs, those foundational life stability needs that we have. And we evaluate all the cases we get for legal merit, and we take the ones that we have resources to take, and we make appropriate referrals and to information or other attorneys whenever we can as well. To give you sort of a sense of a big picture overview of a breakdown of the case types that we handle, about 28% of our cases are family and domestic violence cases. 19% of our cases are protecting elder Minnesotans. 21% of our cases are economic stability cases, and 24% of our cases are housing. So you can see that those are our big practice areas where we're helping people with basic life needs. Just a little bit about our client demographics. So 66% of our clients are female or women-headed households. 53% of our clients come from communities of color. 19% of our clients are age 60 or older, and 3% of our clients are under age 18. 67% of all the cases we do, those 46,000 cases I mentioned, are closed by staff attorneys at the regional legal aid offices or the other legal aid providers in Minnesota, and 33% are closed by private volunteer attorneys who are working on a pro bono basis. So here's the slide where we get to the stark reality that we face every day, which is the need for civil legal aid. So due to lack of resources, we are only able to serve 40% of eligible people who seek our service, meaning that due to the lack of resources, we are forced to turn away 60% of eligible clients. We're actually doing better than we were a few years ago. Our forced turn away rate has gone from 67% down to 60%.
One moment. Chair Constein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year, there was a bill that was introduced that was had a really good idea, and it was for farmers. And it dealt with how you categorize their assets so they would be eligible for legal services. So that would have added to the workload, but we didn't give them any more money. So unfortunately, I mean, as far as the idea, it was, I'm guessing, in the omnibus prime bill. But again, if we can't add to their workload and not provide more funds, and just wanted to bring that up. So if we're looking forward to maybe reintroducing that bill or something, we need to actually do something to increase the funding to go along with it.
Thank you for that observation, Chair Considine. Mr. Schaefer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And in Minnesota, you know, just to illustrate statistically, there's one private attorney for every 324 potential paying clients, compared to one legal aid attorney for every 6,058 low-income individuals. That measurement is done using a 200% of federal poverty guidelines figure. So the need is great, and we, you know, work with the resources we have to serve as many people as we can. For legal services funding by the state of Minnesota, there are three primary sources. One is the general fund appropriation that's will be before this committee. The current funding level is $13.72 million appropriated by the legislature. 85% goes to the regional legal program, regional legal aid programs, and then 15% of that money is administered by the Legal Services Advisory Committee, is granted to all civil legal aid providers in Minnesota who apply for those funds to do the work. Additionally, the interest on lawyers' trust account, which has been a lower source of funding in recent years due to low interest rates, is at about $400,000 as of 2018, and then additionally $2 million in attorney registration fees help to fund legal aid. And all of these funds are distributed through the Minnesota Supreme Court's Legal Services Advisory Committee.
I do have a question because I don't even know the answer to this. Maybe Mr. Walls can help us out on this. Mr. Walls, is this direct pass-through then, or does that money get included in our budget? Do we have fingers on that at all?
Mr. Chair, this is money that is appropriated to the in the Minnesota Supreme Court appropriation, so it does come in funding through this committee, and we do have a say in increasing or changing the funding.
Okay, well, now that gives rise to another question. We don't have any say over, I mean, it's only the Supreme Court that has a say over increasing or decreasing attorneys' surcharges or whatever on their annual registrations, right? I mean, we don't change that. That's just the Supreme Court. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's not something I can answer.
Okay, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, if
yes, please go ahead, Ms. Lesney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you stated is true. The Supreme Court has to approve increasing the attorney registration fee, which it's done. It enacted it, and it has increased once during the time that it's been in effect.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
So this is this slide here, slide 18, is a pie chart that shows how the state appropriation fits in with the overall funding environment for civil legal services using data for 2018. And it is the most important source of funding for civil legal aid. It allows us to do the broad array of work to touch all 87 counties in Minnesota. You know, we are always scrambling to find other sources of revenue to support our work, and we are fortunate to find foundation support or local government support from time to time. We also get support from the Federal Legal Services Corporation for about 12% of the funding for legal aid in Minnesota at this time. But the state appropriation is really enables us to do all of the types of basic life necessities, advocacy that we do day-to-day for Minnesotans.
Okay, Mr. Schaefer, back on that, or Ms. Lasting, whoever can answer it. That Bank of America settlement, was that a structured settlement reached by the Attorney General, or how long ago was that, and who did it, which Attorney General?
Mr. Chair, to the best of my knowledge, it was a national settlement. It happened about 4 years ago. So it was a settlement that resulted in funds going to every state, and that would probably be an area where we can provide you with more detail following the hearing. But it started happening about 4 years. It's a national settlement.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I believe that the cycle for that money will be ending in the next couple of years.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the previous slide and the sources of state-administered funding, and it seems kind of disproportionate that, you know, I understand the general fund. It's one of our roles is to fund the courts and so forth and this service as well. But it seems disproportionate that the general fund appropriation is $13.72 million and the attorney registration fees that they use for this account is just a little bit more than $2 million. So, you know, at the risk of beating up on attorneys, maybe we should be raising their fees and using them for this. So.
Well, that's why I asked Chair Scott, Mr. Walls, if like we have any say on any of that. I already think I pay too much in attorneys' registration fees, just like you all think you pay too much in taxes. But yes, Chair Liebling.
Thanks. I have to jump into this discussion because just to bring up a little parallel that is being discussed right now, and that is the provider tax and the healthcare access fund. And one of the arguments that is sometimes made against the provider tax, or some people like to call it the sick tax, is if we're going to fund certain things, why should we only draw on some people to fund, you know, why should only healthcare providers fund healthcare for poor people? And so when we're talking about this as well, and I, as an attorney, I have no problem paying the fee and funding the stuff, and I give plenty of personal money to a lot of these kinds of causes as well. But if we're going to be, we need to be consistent here. And just to be clear that if we're going to argue that attorneys should fund services for poor people that can't afford attorneys, we should have no problem saying that providers of health care should help fund health care for poor people who don't otherwise have health care. I just wanted to lay that out there because these are arguments that are flying around. And, you know, I actually do think that in a perfect world that we would all pay for the stuff that people need. But we don't always do it that way. But I just wanted to lay that out so that it's in the mix here as we have this discussion.
Sure, Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, to draw the analogy out further is we all do pay for through this particular, through the general fund, and same for health care. So, but there are three sources here, and I just wanted to bring it to the committee's attention that maybe the portion that we get through attorney fees could be up, not necessarily that your fees would have to be increased, but, and I don't know what the other things are funded with the attorney fees that you all pay every year, but just maybe taking a larger portion of that to fund legal services. Thank you.
Chair Johnson. Chair Lash, I look at this as a different way. We're all trying to figure out how we can fund them a little better and make services, provide the services where they're needed. I use a little, sometimes it's not used a lot around here, it's common sense. The example he gave with the mold issue, that should have never gone to the civil legal services to begin with. The way I see that, the doctor should have contacted the county or the city health inspector who would have gone out to that house and placed an order on the property owner to have that repaired before, otherwise wouldn't be able to use that or condemn that place, whichever the property owner chooses, before it gets to civil service. That's something that if the doctor's finding health issues that aren't contacting the county or the city health inspector, we need to know why they're not doing that, because that's what those people are there for, to take care of those problems before it gets to the court system.
Thank you. Any other comments on this? Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my immediate reaction to that is I'd actually really like to hear our testifiers respond to that, why it couldn't happen that way. But from the point of view of the doctor, I just want to say that, you know, we do call on our medical professionals to do a lot of stuff, and it's great if they can do that, but it's, you know, as they get the 15 minutes with the patient, to add to that that they have to go out and make calls to start solving social problems, we might have to increase their reimbursement a lot of times for that, too. So I don't know if that's, you know, in a perfect world, that would be great if they could do that, but I'd like to hear what these folks have to say about what their role is in that kind of scenario and why they feel that won't work in all situations.
Well, members, let's do this. We have another bill on the agenda. We are touching on areas of health care in Chair Liebling's committee and tax committee and how it's appropriately funded, which are legitimate points of discussion. But I just want to be sensitive to the time they have in completing this. But if you want to speak to that briefly on your ability to provide those services, please do. And then after that, Chair Mariani has a question as well, too. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I'll just briefly say that in those types of consultations that we would have with people in that situation, we would be, like we always do, delivering personalized service and thinking about protecting their broader rights. So, for example, in some cases, it might not be the best thing to involve an inspector because, you know, the housing market being what it is in Minnesota, sometimes the risk of retaliation for raising issues with government officials who are responsible for health and safety inspections is a concern for people. So that would be a decision as attorneys that we would make in consultation with our client after explaining all the ramifications of any particular course of action in vindicating their rights.
Thank you. Chair Mariani?
Well, Mr. Chair, very, very quickly, it seems to me to the testifiers that part of the power of our legal system is not only to provide an immediate justice for the plaintiff, it's also, in fact, to my colleague Representative Johnson's observation, it's also about sending strong messages to bad actors out there so that we don't have 1,000 other complainants' clients facing that same issue. And so it seems to me that the power, part of the power of the kind of work that you do clearly is about working directly with individuals, but it's also about making sure that our entire system, from a systems approach, is applying equitable, equal applications of justice so that you don't have 1,000 more clients down the line who are facing, you know, issues like, in this case, you know, a mold issue. I see you nodding. I mean, it seems to me that that's a critical thing that we have to keep in mind as legislators as we make sure we use the people's resources to be able to advance individual rights and then our entire society's rights and sense of fair play.
And before you proceed, I'd just note, members, a couple of decades ago when I was a young man, I bought a rental property, and it was my first one. I bought that thing for $57,000, I immediately poured everything I had into it, about $40,000 in the first year, to try to get this thing up to snuff because it was a dump when I bought it, okay? So $40,000 more than I had, mortgaged myself to the hilt. A year later, one of the tenants at the time had a kid and reported to the doctor that they had high lead levels. And so the county called me and said, hey, are you running a dump over there with lead in it? And I said, I poured every ounce I have into this place. And they said, well, and might be the windows because the kids get their fingers in the windowsills. And if you have old windows, I'm like, well, yeah, the windows are old. And I said, I'll tell you what, we'll spring for 60-70% of the cost of new windows in that unit. And I said, done deal. Okay, yeah. I mean, so it was an everyone wins kind of thing, where I wanted to make sure, and later on it turned out that the lead wasn't from the house I was in. It was from some other source, I think, when the kid was over at her dad's house or something. But in any case, it was folks
trying to address it in a way short of litigation. But if we didn't have that, and let's say I was a deadbeat landlord, then you could have had lawyers come in and say, hold on a second here, we can forge a solution, you know, you're under the hammer, and reach the deal. So I think there is some value to these folks that come in and litigate, that you see the effects long term, that maybe you wouldn't have anticipated, because they do have the sword hanging over them, sword of Damocles, whatever. Go ahead, Mr. Schaefer.
Mr. Chair, thanks. And just to respond briefly, we do part of the services we do deliver, as we do from time to time as resources allow, in addition to giving families that we represent in individual cases a chance at justice. We do pick up bigger impact cases that have raised public visibility about issues and, you know, send a message to the community about the treatment of the clients that we represent. So that is part of what we do. I'll move along really quickly to conclude this. I don't want to be respectful of all of your time. The resources that we are fortunate to get to do the work we do, we leverage them for a wide variety of grants that we get from other sources, and we use technology to amplify the work that we do, as I mentioned, with LawHelp MN, which we are relaunching soon in a new modern platform that will be very useful to the people of Minnesota to access legal help. And just to kind of highlight at a real high level some of the dollar benefits for clients, for the 20,000 plus families that we provided full representation services to last year, over $22 million in benefits achieved for those clients, as well as stabilizing them, making them safer, allowing them to better pay for daily necessities, making them better able to keep or find a job, and putting them in a healthier, safer, and more stable housing situation. Several years ago, we worked with an economist and the State Bar Association and put together this return on investment graphic. So we shared this with you in the materials. We also included it in the slideshow just to highlight that just short of $4 is returned to the community for every dollar invested in civil legal aid. And some of the statistics, you know, we haven't updated this in a couple years. It was a resource-intensive undertaking to put it together, but the return on investment data is something that's being looked at around the country, and it's very consistent with other research around the country on what is returned to the community for every dollar invested in civil legal aid. And before I conclude, I just wanted to, at a very high level, highlight what our request is going to be. The current general fund appropriation is $27.44 million for fiscal years 2018 and 19, and we're requesting an increase of a little over $1.6 million for fiscal year 2020 and about $2.5 million for fiscal year 2021, for a total of about a $4 million increase for the next biennium cycle for our state appropriation. And the primary reasons for this increase, which we are requesting, which you will hear more about when we talk to you individually and when we come back again to present, is that we have by far the lowest salaries for public interest and public sector employers. We start at year one attorneys at an average of about $48,000 a year, which is at about 87% of the public defender's office. And I know you heard from them about how their salaries compare to other public sector and public interest employers. So and when you go up the salary schedule to year 10 or year 20, we're farther and farther behind. We have also all experienced, to varying degrees, pretty significant increases in fixed costs, especially health insurance, for our operations. So just to maintain our current service levels and to maintain our ability to serve the number of people who are coming to us at the rate that we are presently doing, this is an important investment that we are requesting to be able to do that. We have seen turnover rates as high as 25% or 30% in some of our programs over the last year. And finally, I'll just end by saying, you know, we really, what we do is we do give families and individuals across Minnesota a chance at justice, and we are providing access to justice and seeking justice for all. And we're doing it in all the ways that we've discussed this morning, and making the justice system as a whole work more efficiently and effectively for Minnesotans. the last page of the presentation has the contact information for the executive directors of all the programs. We encourage you to connect with us with any questions that you have, and we look forward to meeting with all of you, talking to you more about our work, and talking to you more about our request in the coming days, weeks, and months. So really appreciate all of your time this morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to all of you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Schaefer, thank you so much. You do provide critical services. And I was just curious, of the 40% of the cases that you are able to handle, the 60% you have to turn down, how do you make that decision about which cases are the ones you're going to take on?
Mr. Schaefer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller, it's a gut-wrenching decision week to week in our case review meetings when we sit around and talk about all the new cases that came in and what we're going to be able to do for the folks that need help, because we know that we can make a difference in any particular case if we are able to put an attorney on it to represent the family. So, you know, we are always using the limited resources we have and figuring out ways to be the most efficient and effective in triaging up front at the intake stage of things and making sure that we're looking at who has the most urgent and emergent need for crisis, who's facing an eviction hearing in court next week, who has a need to get an order for protection in the coming days to protect their life and safety. That's the type of discussions that we're having at our offices on a daily basis. So it is, I've sat in those meetings for many, many times over the last 13 years, and it's definitely a challenge. But we are always doing what we can to make sure that we're, you know, prioritizing families and protecting them and looking at cases that have the most emergent and urgent needs and trying to meet them when we know that we can deliver a legal intervention to solve their problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to highlight, actually going back to the salary, a attorney in civil legal services, it's truly public service. I've actually known a couple of guys that have done this for an extended period of time that I know could walk out and double, triple their salary. And the other thing, back to Representative Mueller's question, is the, in my former life, you know, referring people to legal services, and the number of them that had come back and said they're too full, they can't take my case, and what else can I do? And there were no other services for them. So, like I said, this is truly public service, and they do work far cheaper than anybody else in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Constantine. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi. I just had a couple questions about the funding, and honestly, you can just get back to me because I know we have another bill to consider, but a couple of questions were, one of the sheets says you turn away 40%, another one says 60%, so I wondered about that discrepancy. And then when you look at the slide about civil legal services funding for the sources of state funding, that totals to $16.1 million. But then when you look at the later slide, it says your appropriation has been $27.4 million. So if you could just clarify that discrepancy, and then it says that your state appropriation is 36% of total budget, but the 27.4 would really be 69% of total budget. So anyway, if you can speak to it now, great. If not, if you could just get back to me on all that, I'd love to understand the numbers better.
Mr. Chair,
just very briefly, the $27.44 million is spread out over 2 years. So okay. $13.72 million per year for a total of $27.44 million over a two-year biennium.
So
the $13.72 million is a one-year funding figure.
Right.
The $27.44 million covers 2 years of biennium for the appropriation.
And so is the person.
Robbins.
Forgive me, Mr. Chair. So is the total percentage then based on that annual or the biennium?
It's based on annual.
Annual. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Nora.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. to the testifier, thank you so much for the good work, excellent work that you do. The question that I have is, given that 53% of clients that you serve are people of color, how many attorneys do you have who are people of color in your, you know, organizations and institutions?
Mr. Schaefer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Noor, that's information that we can get together and provide back to you. I do know that we have a very diverse staff working in our offices around the state, and we're very proud of the diversity of our staff, including language diversity and diversity that represents the communities that we serve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other members' questions? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, and again, maybe this doesn't have to be answered right now, but obviously your budget request is kind of a limited one, that you're telling us that you're not able to meet the needs in the state, and you have to turn away cases. And I'm kind of, I don't know if the chair would be with me on this so much, but I would really like to know what it would take, in your estimation, to actually meet the need as we consider the requests that you're making. Because even though, obviously, there are a lot of needs in our state that we're not able to meet, I think it would help us as a legislature if we understood clearly what we're doing and what we're not doing. And so I would encourage you to at least let us know, even if it's not in your actual budget request, but to bring that forward. The corollary to that is that I'm aware that in what you do is so many other parts of our economy that even if you had the money, you might not be able to get the people. So it would be really interesting to hear a bit more, maybe not now, but of you know, how the workforce shortage, because there aren't, even though we sometimes, you know, it's a joke that there are so many lawyers, but in fact, there really aren't so many lawyers, especially so many lawyers willing to do the kind of work, the really critical, important work that you guys do. So I'd like to hear a bit about that, maybe not now, though. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And, Mr. Schaefer, that's somewhat of a rhetorical question and somewhat of a direct question. But I my question dovetailed off of that, which was, given that the salaries of your attorneys are so low and given that you don't have enough attorneys to meet the need, if this committee gives you your increase, are you going to use it to increase salaries or are you going to use it to meet the need?
Mr. Chair, great question, and the answer is really both. The answer is we are going to invest in compensation increase to help retain staff that we have right now and also to recruit new staff and to hopefully stabilize our situation, which will improve service to the people of Minnesota.
Well, okay, and thank you for that. And, you know, it's not just a question for you. That's my question for the public defenders as well. Their salaries are low, and they have unmet need, and I will tell you, I'm sure management would want to use that money to fill gaps and meet need and reduce caseload, and if you ask the union, they're going to say, well, yeah, but we kind of need salaries increased too. So there's a tension there. And then going to Chair Liebling's question about how we thread this needle, how much of an impact can we make, and then also that need question is very subjective. I went to a conference once in law school that was compromised mostly of conservatives, and they were just lamenting the scourge of SMERLs, and how they're going after these poor landlords who are just trying to eke out a buck, and that was a very different perspective. I'm sure they think there isn't a need, that these needs are superfluous at best, and vindictive at worst, maybe. I don't know. But that's a question, that's a debate that we have in this committee about where the need is. Because when you just throw out that word need, every person on this committee is going to approach that from a different perspective, and we gotta figure that out. So I think Chair Liebling's question is well put, and hopefully you can digest that and come back with a good answer for us, too. Chair Johnson?
Chair Lesh, and for the testifiers as well, something to and for our committee to consider. I'm just wondering what percentage of your cases actually go to court, because if we increase staff and more cases are going to go to court, And same with the public defenders. If more cases end up going to court, that's going to jam up our courts, and we have it's going to be a ripple effect through the entire judicial system. And we got to be careful how we do that so we don't totally jam up the court so nobody has any service.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Chair Johnson. Any other questions? Seeing none, then, Ms. Lestine and Mr. Schaefer, thank you very much for appearing before us. We'll look forward to hear you when we consider the budget presentations closer to when we get targets. And thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
That said, members, I am going to hand over the gavel to my able vice chair, Representative Mueller, while I present a bill that we don't have possession of. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill we will be hearing next will refer to as HFX. It's a copy of the 2018 bill, HF 2309, and it's before us today for informational purposes only. And after Chair Lesh presents his bill and we hear from testifiers, it will be laid over. And with that, Chair Lesh, welcome to your committee.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be here, Madam Chair. Now, members, House Bill 2309, first off, was included as on the list of non-controversial portions of Omnibus Prime from last year. And there's a kind of a long story behind it, I'll restate it in brief. Around 2007, 2008, 9, 10, there was the advent of additional surveillance technologies, which came about, I think, in 2011 regarding a blow-up over Stingray and Kingfish with the head of the county sheriff and BCA. Members of this committee were surprised to learn about it, apparently even though it was approved by the head of the county board like a couple years prior. And so there were questions about how this was being used. At the same time, we entered into issues related to license plate readers, which blew up in 2012 when the Star Tribune ran a piece about they knew where Mayor R.T. Ryback was every minute of his day based upon him passing by certain automated license plate readers. On the heels of that came the issues regarding the technology of police body cameras and how that data was being collected and used. So this bill, even though the tracking warrants specifically related more to issues before the license plate readers and the body cameras, it still related to this committee's concerns about how government was collecting data on individuals who were not yet charged with a crime, let alone found guilty of anything, so innocent people. And then how that was disclosed by the government at the time. So we came up with, and I was only on the periphery of this debate at the time, we came up with a new model, which was tracking warrants. Because under the previous regime, if government was getting warrants on these individuals, they never had to disclose how they were using these, how pervasive the technology was, who they were tracking, and why. So we came up with a system that stated that, okay, with the tracking warrant, you had to disclose that information 90 days after you closed the investigation. So either you got the bad guy or found out it wasn't a bad guy, and 90 days later, you disclose that so we'd get to know, okay, how were you using this? And so there's a little bit of oversight there, and it's not all happening in secret in the dark of night. Well, Fox 9 ran a piece about a year after we passed this and it got enacted and found out that not a single tracking warrant had been disclosed, not a single one. And that surprised me. I think it probably surprised Chair Scott. And I thought, okay, sometimes we pass bills around this place and they either get slow walked or hidden or sidestepped or whatever, and it kind of irritates us as a committee because we have a certain intent. It came out that maybe we didn't perfectly phrase these this bill the way that we intended. So, for example, when law enforcement comes in, they just throw everything against the wall and see what sticks with these warrants, okay, which is not surprising. It's probably the way most of us would do this. You apply for the warrant under a bunch of different theories, and hopefully you get it under one or more of them. Well, these theories spanned across the tracking warrant language that we use. So even if a judge was able to disclose the contents of the tracking warrant, that warrant was still predicated on language in law that would not make it be public. Or maybe in some cases even under federal law, which would not make it be public. So that put us in a quandary. What's a judge supposed to do when you have two competing laws, the tracking warrant that says disclose it, but other provisions of law that says that it's sealed? Well, I guess we didn't think about that hard enough back when we passed this. So we need to take a look at it again. This is the language in this House File 2309 that came out in Omnibus Prime last year that was supposed to be a start of fixing that. I think maybe it's still not perfect. I have spoke with a couple of people who said, how is it that a judge, a judicial officer, is supposed to disclose this when they don't have the information that they need in order to disclose it? I don't imagine they really want the additional job of doing it anyway, but their statement is, I think, we don't have their address, we don't know where they are, we don't know what to disclose to whom. So that's the posture we find ourselves now with this bill, and it was, as I stated in committee the other day, the intent of Majority Leader Gazelka and Speaker Hortman that we have hearings on the consensus items from last year's Omnibus Prime and see if we can pass them again as consensus items. And so that's what the intent is of this hearing now, to have that hearing and then potentially take action on the bill this year when it gets dropped and we have possession of it. So that's a little background, and I have with me here Ben Feist from the ACLU who can speak to their support of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Feist. Please again identify yourself for the record and tell us who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ben Feist. I am the legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. Folks new to the committee might not be familiar with the ACLU of Minnesota in particular, but we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to defending the civil rights and civil liberties of all Minnesotans under the U.S. and Minnesota constitutions. We currently have over 40,000 members throughout the state of Minnesota, and our members and supporters, and promote our mission through litigation, community engagement, and lobbying efforts. So I'm here today to testify in support of this bill, as I did in previous sessions. The ACLU was heavily involved in the original debate over cell phone location tracking back in 2014, and I won't go into a lot of that detail because Chair Lesh did a great job describing a lot of the pieces there. So just to jump in to say ultimately that this was a very controversial practice, whether it's a cell site simulator like this Stingray that is able to ping someone's cell phone location directly with law enforcement, or going directly to the providers to try to figure out the historic patterns of someone's movements. Either way, we are getting really invasive information, very private information about the location and movements of people. So this really raises a lot of privacy and technology concerns for the ACLU. We ultimately did support the tracking warrant requirement back in 2014, which, unlike the statutes for the pen registers, trap and trace devices, and the older mobile tracking devices like the GPS pieces that you'd put on a car and then follow that around, the new law provided most of the protections of a traditional search warrant and could apply to both real-time tracking and historic location tracking by law enforcement. But importantly for today's discussion, it was very essential that we also made sure that folks who were tracked would eventually get notice that these things would be unsealed, and that court administration could report back to the legislature and to the public whether these types of technologies were being used 50, 500, or 5,000 times a year. So without that kind of information, we don't know how pervasive this is and whether this body should take additional action. So we, too, were disappointed when the first report came out, and it appeared that there was a perceived conflict in what type of information could be disclosed by the courts. And we hope that this clarifies the legislative intent from 2014 and is remains non-controversial to move this forward. So we look forward to getting this done this year. But with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Oh, Representative.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Lesh. Do you have any, I was just wondering if you could have any idea or know what these tracking warrants are being used for?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson, no, because none of them have been disclosed. So it's all a mystery until we get the information on what they are used for.
Okay.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Chair Lesh, members, these warrants are used for a number of different things, investigations, homicide investigations, missing persons, but the biggest thing they're used for is finding runaway and lost kids. They're used all the time. And I would like to know if when we actually have the bill, we can get here somebody from the judicial system here to answer the questions why they haven't been disclosing the information. Law enforcement has no problem doing this, but it's and I've talked with some of the investigators, some of the people involved. They have no problem why it's released. They don't know why the judicial branch is not releasing it.
Well, Madam Chair and Chair Johnson, I can tell you what the judicial branch is going to say. They're going to say that these warrants are applied for under various sections of the law, one of which is this language we passed in 2014 that says it has to be disclosed. The warrants are also applied for under several other provisions of law which make that information sealed. So they don't want to be in a position of disclosing it under our new law, which would violate other provisions of law. At least that's how I understand, at least that's what I understand of their objection as it stands. And that sounds reasonable until I'm proven wrong and it's presented to me that some other reason, but yeah, I think it's worthwhile. I would note this too, Chair Johnson, that the judiciary is loath to, they don't like to come and testify before these committees. They, as you know, right, all my information is back channel, so it can avoid the appearance of partiality. But yes, we do get, you know, a lot of our information we'll get from law enforcement. I don't know if Mr. Evans is going to testify or county attorney is going to testify on it. My understanding is this is relatively consensus, and hopefully we can get this ironed out in the next few weeks.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Chair Lesh, I agree. We'll continue this conversation offline. Maybe we can get somebody from the judiciary to bring up their concerns, why they're having an issue, so we can get it taken care of.
Thank you.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've been off this committee for a number of years, so I haven't been following these things very closely. And I'd just like to ask kind of a foundational question, that not really the bill itself, but about the warrant. And that is that not too long ago, the New York Times had a pretty astounding article about how when we carry our phones around, most of us use, I don't know, Google Maps, we have location service turned on our phone, and you could all check your phone. I bet almost everybody in this room has their location turned on. That information is being collected, it's being packaged, it's being sold, it's moving around like nobody's business, and that you can buy that information and just go, and it may not be purchasable with individual identification, but if you have a little information about a person, you can literally know where they go every day, and you can buy that. So I'm wondering how that fits in with this idea of the warrant requirement. Does law enforcement need a warrant to go out and buy publicly available information to try to track an individual? I mean, I can only imagine there must be many, many reasons why you might want to do this, as Representative Johnson talked about. Does that fall under this warrant requirement, or has technology just completely washed past us in our ability to keep any control over this?
Well, Madam Chair and Chair Liebling, I think that's an excellent question. That's the very crux of the philosophy or policy decisions that we make here. There could be a point very soon where we realize it doesn't matter, because all of us have given up so much information regarding our whereabouts or what we're doing, that any conclusions may be drawn about whether there's probable cause to issue a warrant against us or what have you. I would say that some of that was revealed in the whole FBI Apple fight from a few years ago, when the FBI said, we have no way to crack the San Bernardino shooter's phone. We demand that Apple provide a backdoor hack to open up every individual's iPhone, and that we can get your information off your iPhone if we need it. And Apple said, no. Apple, for those of you who don't know, is probably at the forefront of insisting on privacy components of your technology in one way or another. There may be debate about that, but I think it's relatively a consensus item. And ultimately, they were able to stall that in the Ninth Circuit until the FBI finally said, well, forget it, we can hack it, we already could force it open. But they wanted that precedent so that it made it a lot smoother and a lot easier to get that information. It was never really about whether they could get access to the phone. It was about the legal precedent to make it more available. And I would even admit reasonable minds can disagree about whether this is. In my opinion, in that case, the San Bernardino shooter was dead. His accomplice was dead. All the people there were dead, tragically. And the question was whether or not they could still force this open to address justice in that case, to see if there was anyone else involved that we could pin on or make the scapegoat for this tragedy because they were still alive. I realize that's a pejorative way of stating it. However, that debate will continue to rage. It'll rage nationally, and it will rage in this state. And it will be about, you know, whether we're just trying to find these missing kids, these poor missing kids, or whether, you know, people are entitled to their privacy for one obscure reason or another. So I appreciate you bringing it up. We're going to continue to have this conversation as other technologies come online, some of which we don't even know about yet, and the debate will come up for y'all when I'm long gone from this place. So thank you for the question.
And I have a related question to that. Wasn't there a recent United States Supreme Court decision regarding law enforcement's ability to use certain tracking devices?
Well, U.S. v. Jones, that wasn't that recent. Were you talking about that one? I think that was 2013.
I thought there was a more recent one.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Yes, Chair Scott.
Thank you. Yeah, there is, and it was this summer, and it was Carpenter v. U.S. And what it did was, what had happened is, my understanding is, law enforcement had gone directly to the cell phone carrier, mm-hmm. so a Verizon or whoever, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Feist, maybe you know more about this, but the Supreme Court of the United States says, no, you can't do that, you have to have a warrant. And there was actually, I brought up this just very brief quote, can I read this real quick from the Supreme Court? The Constitution must take into account technological changes, Chief Justice Roberts wrote, noting that digital data can provide a comprehensive, detailed, and intrusive overview of private affairs that would have been impossible to imagine not long ago. And so there was Jones, and prior to that there was even a case called Katz. That was clear back in 1967. So I think that the courts are clear that a warrant is necessary. But to Representative or Chair Liebling's point, I mean, you don't even have to have your location turned on. You can have your phone completely turned off, and they can still track your whereabouts. That's been tested. And so, and I don't know what is available. Yeah, I know. Let's all go back to landlines and dumb phones. It certainly is a problematic world that we live in when we're talking about issues like this when it involves justice.
Thank you. I would note, I think Rip Sidnor has a question.
Oh, yeah. I think Chair Considine did too first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last summer, Grand Avenue, two couples, we walked into the ice cream place, had a cone, walked across the street, and my wife's phone dinged, and it said, would you care to evaluate such and such an ice cream place? And frankly, I trust law enforcement more than I do the ice cream place.
Representative Knorr.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, the question is, we're talking about electronic device. Does that include software? You know, sometimes people can have different definitions for what it is. So when you say electronic device, how do we define that? And when somebody says, I only have a software that can do the work that I need to do, you know, they can harvest the information, do other things. We have seen that in social media and other places. But we have to be more definitive when we say electronic devices.
That's a fair point. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Rep. Newer, thank you for that. I would note that those definitions are going to be further clarified and tightened up as more of these technologies come online and as more people care about it. And I realize we might get to a point where a lot of people really don't care about this. I'm not under any illusions, okay? Many people would prefer they do prefer the convenience of when they Google something, on Google, and then they're 5 minutes later or 30 seconds later on their Facebook, and they're getting Facebook ads for that thing that they Googled. Just reveals the data sharing and everything that they know about you, because that's money. That's money in their pocket. And a lot of people will say, well, that's excellent. I love to be able to get sent information about what I'm looking for, and then it makes it more convenient for me. I think it was when Michelle Bachmann was running for something, and it was State Fair, and people at the State Fair were getting dinged with, hey, come visit Michelle. They knew you were at the State Fair. Come visit Michelle Bachmann at the booth or whatever. And people say, how do you know I'm at the State Fair? Some people were offended by it. Some people did not care. And there will continue to be people who do not care about this that much, because they're like, well, forget it. As long as we can find one missing kid, I do not care how much we go into people's daily lives. And then other people will say, well, I'm going to count up these number of people whose lives were sidelined and maybe spent a little time in jail until it was discovered that they were innocent, simply because the information on their device, the metadata, was used to implicate them in something that they had nothing to do with, because of our lack of sophistication on how to use and deal with this at this point. So there are two different perspectives on this that we'll continue to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify about this bill? Any other questions from members? Hearing none, Chair Lesh, your bill, it won't be laid over since we don't have a number yet, but we will be voting on that at a later date.
Thank you. And I do. I would add, Madam Chair, that there will be a point where I may have some comfort language that I would hope we would have by now, so that law enforcement or the BCA could speak to it, and we don't have it yet. But I will tell you that it will probably shift the responsibility away from the bench to the applicant for reporting. Oh, we'll see how that shakes out.
Thank you.
Adjourn.
You have to gavel.
Adjourn.
Adjourn. Oh, no, are we doing more? No, you can close. I was told you were going to be resuming the gavel, Mr. Chair. But
oh, you're going to be adjourning the meeting, Madam Chair. So you can
all right.
Bang that
well, that's
gavel.
Exciting. I didn't know I'd get to actually use the gavel today.
Yeah.
So that's really exciting for me. So I guess with that, the meeting is adjourned.
Excellent.
All right.
Thank you.